This week, this familiar voice was stilled.
Do you, Ambassador Zorin, deny that the USSR has placed and is placing medium and intermediate range missiles and sites in Cuba? Yes or no? Don't wait for the translation. Yes or no?
An invasion of Mars took place for a change.
It was fortunate that we did indeed get the first picture with the edge of the planet showing as you see.
And a new film, Will Success Spoil John Birch, made its debut.
Serving without compensation and often at great cost to themselves, these men truly are a credit not only to the John Birch Society, but to their country as well.
Good evening. This is The World This Week. I'm Alexander Kendrick. It was a week in which speculation about life on another planet was intertwined with sorrow for the death of a citizen of this planet. Today, Adlai Stevenson of Illinois is home again in Illinois for the last time. The books he wanted to read will remain unread. The wine he wanted to sip while watching people dance will remain untasted. The man whom the nation mourned with more grief than anyone since John F. Kennedy died on a London street this week on his way back from a United Nations Economic and Social Council meeting in Geneva, where he spoke for the United States, as he has been speaking for it since 1961. Less than an hour before he died, Adlai Stevenson made his last public utterance on behalf of the United States in a radio interview recorded for the BBC. He was asked about liberal sentiment in this country on Vietnam and its effect on him.
There has been a great deal of pressure on me in the United States from many sources to take a position, a public position inconsistent with that of my government. Actually, I don't agree with those protestants. My hope in Vietnam is that resistance there may establish the fact that changes in Asia are not to be precipitated by outside force. This was the point of the Korean War. This is the point of the conflict in Vietnam.
The news of Adlai Stevenson's death went in shockwaves around the world. As the tributes and eulogies began to pour in, President Johnson, who had been visibly moved, expressed the nation's feelings on radio and television.
His great hero, Abraham Lincoln, said at the beginning of his political career, "I have no other ambition so great as that of being truly esteemed of my fellow men by rendering myself worthy of their esteem." And although his disappointments were many, in this, like Lincoln, he was vindicated. Like Lincoln, he was rooted in America's heartland. Yet his voice reached across every boundary of nation and race and class. Like Lincoln, he was a great emancipator. It was his gift to help emancipate men from narrowness of mind and the shackles which selfishness and ignorance place upon the human adventure. Like Lincoln, he will be remembered more for what he stood for and for the offices he held.
A delegation headed by Vice President Humphrey brought Adlai Stevenson's body home from London in the president's plane. Memorial services were held in the National Cathedral, Washington, yesterday, with the president and Mrs. Johnson attending. This weekend, the final chapter in the Stevenson story takes place in the Capitol building at Springfield, Illinois, where the former governor lies in state. He will be buried in his hometown of Bloomington on Monday. But it is not, of course, the final chapter, for his eloquence and his wit will long be remembered, and moments like these after his first defeat for the presidency in 1952.
Someone asked me as I came in down on the street how I felt. And I was reminded of a story that a fellow townsman of ours used to tell, Abraham Lincoln. They asked him how he felt once after an unsuccessful election.
We want Adlai!
He said he felt like a little boy who had stubbed his toe in the dark, that he was too old to cry, but it hurt too much to laugh.
Adlai Stevenson never got the chance to sleep in Lincoln's bed in the White House, but he lies on Lincoln's bier in the State House. Springfield is the city which, he said, gave him the best years of his life, but as he would have wryly noted, neither Lincoln nor he could carry it when running for president. The World This Week continues in a moment. Whatever it is that makes Mars a red planet, it is not a red carpet of welcome for Earthlings. Finally, this week, after 7 months and 135 million miles of space travel, the first interplanetary flight of science fact, the probe ship Mariner 4 made its photo reconnaissance of Mars and sent back data indicating that, because of the exceptionally thin atmosphere, life as we know it could exist there only in rudimentary form, if at all. But despite some disappointment to science fiction readers, the Mariner 4 adventure was a major million milestone in space. The data from Mariner 4 breaks new ground, or rather new space, in scientific study. But it doesn't quite answer the question of whether there is life on Mars. Dr. William H. Pickering, director of the Jet Propulsion Lab.
Mariner was not expected to answer the question of life on Mars. Mariner was the first step in the exploration of Mars. The succeeding interplanetary program, particularly the Voyager, which will land a capsule on the surface, will, we hope, give the key answers to this question.
2 days after Mariner 4's rendezvous with Mars came the 20th anniversary of the cataclysmic event which opened a new age for mankind, encompassing the space age. From the site with the codename Trinity in the New Mexico desert where the first atomic explosion occurred, CBS News correspondent Murray Fromson reported to The World This Week.
There are few reminders here at the test site of that historic day. Today, the Trinity test site is as quiet as a cemetery. Fenced off, it is almost unmarked. Warning signs to keep out are weather-beaten and unreadable. The crater left by the bomb, 400 yards in radius and 25 feet at its deepest point, is invisible to the naked eye. Scrub brush and plants, which would not grow for years after, now flourish only inches from ground zero. The major inhabitants are rattlesnakes and roadrunners. Particles of sand fused by the atomic blast are scattered around the site. Turned to a green, glassy substance called trinitite, they are still slightly radioactive. Most of them have been blown or carried away by scientists and souvenir hunters. The desert has claimed whatever else remains. The ranch house, 2 miles away, where the bomb was assembled, then taken to the tower. And the command bunker, 10,000 yards from ground zero, where Dr. J. Robert Oppenheimer and his associates gave the final order to detonate the bomb. The countdown ended at 5:30 a.m. Mountain War Time, July 16, 1945. President Truman was at Potsdam when he was advised that the atom bomb test was a success. He was handed a coded message which read, "Babies born successfully." Not before or since has one birth caused so much fear and so much hope.
The Russians are as much interested in Mars as the Americans and have made an unsuccessful probe of their own. But this week they stayed with the moon and contented themselves with launching the largest spaceship ever launched. In fact, what appeared to be a space station weighing 13 tons with what appeared to be the world's most powerful booster rocket. The World This Week continues after this message. The question of life on Mars is still an unanswered one, but if it does exist, it would seem to be lacking in variety. There is no lack of variety in the life and activity on this planet, however, and this week had its full share of it. Not as far away as Mars, not so far as the moon, but still up there, men encountered peril. A four-engine radar reconnaissance plane on a mission from Otis Air Force Base had to ditch when one of the engines failed and cracked up. 9 aboard were killed, 7 are missing and presumed drowned. There were 3 survivors, and 2 of them spoke to reporters when they were brought ashore by a West German destroyer on maneuvers which had picked them up.
What happened when you hit the water?
I don't remember much.
What was the first thing you remembered, Lieutenant, after hitting the water?
Blub, blub. It's going up.
Remember how you got out of the...
I just went up and up and up and up. Got away from the aircraft because it was sinking, and I was scared I might be sucked under by going down, so I just got away from the aircraft. And
did you see any of your buddies?
I got with some other fellas and
We stayed together. There were several of us that stayed together. Well, there were several of us, let's say it that way.
What happened to them?
I don't know, sir. They drifted away.
Politics in this country is a many-splendored thing, and one of its splendors is public relations, the image. This week, the John Birch Society was in the film business and gave a preview of a new screen epic in New York. Steve Rowan went as film critic for The World This Week.
Were it not for the first 20 minutes and the last 15, the John Birch Society's second attempt to present itself on film would be very much like an industrial film showing what goes on behind the scenes in the manufacturing of tractors. The soft cell center of the 90-minute presentation is filled with such things as a carefully staged monthly chapter meeting, starting and ending punctually, of course. The members are pleasant, obviously a cross-section of the best elements in any community. This completely positive presentation tries to prove, just as the tractor company does when it makes such a film, that it has a better product than anyone else because of its responsible management and devoted employees, or in this case, members. But it ends up being proof of something else, the organizing abilities of Robert Welch, who founded the society in December of 1958. Before the soft sell portion, for the first 20 minutes, there's something else. A cleverly done documentary on the life of John Birch and his untimely death at the hands of the Chinese communists. The first American casualty, as the narrator explains ominously, of World War III. And then comes the explanation of the society's founding by the narrator, a pleasant-looking society employee named G. Edward Griffin.
In the beginning, the society was just an idea in the mind of one man. But soon this man attracted to him some of the most prominent leaders in the American conservative movement. Today, these men comprise the council or the governing body of the John Birch Society. These men truly are a credit not only to the John Birch Society, but to their country as well.
Until Robert Welch comes on the screen, about an hour and 15 minutes into the film, there's no hard sell and no attempt to answer criticism. Welch admits the society is monolithic, but if it were democratic, he explains, the communists would infiltrate. And besides, anyone who doesn't like it can quit. On the subject of the part played by the communications media, Welch has this to say.
The smooth certainty with which communist influences now bring the leading periodicals, for instance, to follow every step in the communist line is readily indicated by one experience involving ourselves. The New York Times, Life, Look, Time, and every major publication which gave fulsome support to Castro, even after the proof that he was a communist had become unmistakable, has also played a leading role in condemning the John Birch Society since it became clear that the society was a threat to the communists. And in general, the same thing is equally true of radio and television.
Welch ends his pitch by saying, in almost so many words, either you're with the John Birch Society or you're with the communists. And if everyone accepted the society's goals, he adds, the communist conspiracy would be dead in 3 months. This film, called simply Presentation Film Number 2, is to be shown in tandem with Presentation Film Number 1, a gathering of some of the speeches made by Welch. The society says it does not allow anyone to charge for showing the films. Sitting through 180 minutes of John Birch Society dogma should be payment enough.
Well, Steve, I suppose a soft sell, like a soft answer, frequently turneth away wrath. But how soft can the American mail get? That report in a moment. For one thing, it's July, which brings on the dog days and what editors call hot weather stories. But for another thing, there may be something new happening beneath and even on the epidermal surface of American life. The name of the game is cosmetics, even for men. And Lily Dache is one of the players of the game, as she talks to our reporter, Drew Smith.
You've made quite a name not only in fashion and hats, but in cosmetics. Do you ever see that men will be wearing cosmetics?
I certainly do. You know, one of the most he-man, a police commissioner of New York City, Grover Whalen, late Grover Whalen, always put rouge on his face because it helped him. And why not? After all, you know, man went the first one that wore hair pieces throughout history. And women now wear wigs. They don't make a secret about it. And I'm sure men in very short time will realize that anything that makes them look better, that will make them put their best face forward, it will do exactly the same thing. After all, you know, beauty is the best passport that we have. You know, it opens 1,000 doors.
Well, it takes all kinds, as Adlai Stevenson would have said. Only, of course, he would have said it much more eloquently. This is an epilogue. It did not have to be asked for whom the bell tolled on Friday morning at the National Cathedral in Washington. It tolled not only for Adlai Stevenson, but for us whom he served and to whom he had been faithful in his fashion, though often we seem dubious of the faith and scornful of the fashion. In the world's councils, his was at once recognized as the authentic voice of America, but it was a voice that many Americans may have come to be deaf to, the voice of restraint, of humility, of understanding. When he was nominated for president in 1952, he declared that self-criticism is the secret weapon of democracy. This will make all the books of quotations, but there is no sign that it has had any effect on American policymaking. Patriotism, said Stevenson once, is not short, frenzied bursts of emotion, but the tranquil and steady dedication of a lifetime. He was not speaking about himself, but he was. The World This Week was produced by Ike Pappas. This is Alexander Kendrick. Good night.
The World This Week was pre-recorded. 9 out of 10 forest fires are caused by human carelessness with cigarettes, matches, campfires. Don't be careless, be careful. This is the CBS Radio Network.